Oregonians have launched an initiative to remove all animal abuse exemptions from farming, ranching, and hunting. And so we ask, should farming, ranching, and hunting be canceled to prevent animal abuse?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1283rd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in St. Petersport who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, in Oregon, anyone who intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causes physical injury or cruelly causes the death of an animal is guilty of animal abuse. Baked into the law, however, is an exemption for good animal husbandry, and that includes common farming and ranching practices like branding and dehorning cattle. But that exemption is insufficient for some animal rights activists, and they have kicked off an initiative drive that, if successful, would likely cancel farming, ranching, and hunting, and even setting a rat trap in your garage. Their initiative, called Abuse, Neglect, and Assault Exemption Modification and Improvement Act, would not only end the animal husbandry exemption, but would classify breeding livestock as sexual abuse of an animal, and that's a Class C felony. The initiative would also remove protections for hunting, fishing, rodeos, slaughtering, and so on and so on and so on. Slaughtering livestock, you couldn't butcher an animal, wildlife management, pest control, and scientific research, just about everything when it gets right down to it. According to the S on 13 website, the initiative would create a system in Oregon where farmers, ranchers are no longer exempt from animal cruelty laws. It would require that animals be allowed to truly live a good life, free from abuse, neglect, and sexual assault. This effort to protect animals leads us to ask, should farming, ranching, and hunting be canceled to prevent animal abuse? And it seems like a crazy thing to ask, but it seems like that's where we're headed. And so let's pick up the subject with Marianne Cooper, who is the Vice President of Public Policy, Oregon Farm Bureau. Marianne, thank you so much for joining us on the Food Chain. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So what did you think when this came out? As a agricultural professional, as somebody who represents the farm community in Oregon, what did you think?
Honestly, I thought even for Oregon, which, you know, tends to be a pretty progressive state, it went further than anything I had ever seen before. And honestly, I think I was shocked that somebody would want to go that far. You know, we've definitely heard from people over the years that don't think we should, you know, eat animals or don't think we should raise animals domestically for food. But I've never met somebody, for example, that knowingly wanted to make it so we couldn't trap a rat in the house. And I do think that the proponents understand the full breadth of the measure and are making a conscious decision to, you know, say you cannot trap a rat in your house, or you can, you know, for no reason, can you kill a animal or fish?
Do you know of anyone in Oregon farming in the farm or ranch community that mistreats animals? I mean, do you know?
Absolutely not. No. And anybody that does would not be in business for very long. And I will say, just anecdotally, I guess I think it's a misnomer, the characterization that farmers and ranchers are exempt from animal abuse statutes. There are exemptions that recognize that there are times that animals may be injured, you know, incidental to good animal husbandry practices, like doctoring your animal. Think about if you accidentally, you know, are cutting your dog's claws and nick too far and, you know, cut the quick. That kind of thing would technically be causing injury to an animal, or, you know, death in the case of slaughtering. And those, there's good animal husbandry practices that apply to all of those activities. as it stands. And so, you know, the places that we have seen people prosecuted are not, you know, big multi-generational farms or ranches. It's often folks that, you know, think of people that they start with buying, you know, one horse, and all of a sudden they have 15 horses and they can't take care of them. And, you know, a lot of those kinds of hoarding scenarios. So it is not your multi-generational family farms and ranches that are ever doing what I think anyone would consider abuse or neglect. It's often people with kind of their own underlying mental conditions that start to acquire animals and cannot stop and are not able to take care of them. And so for us, you know, the cornerstone of a successful farm or ranch business is happy, healthy animals, and you will not be in business very long if you do not have happy, healthy animals.
Yeah, if you had a stable of race cars, for example, you wouldn't want to abuse them because you'd want them to win the race. And if you have animals that with which you earn your living, you would want to treat them as best as you possibly could. I knew the farm that I was raised on had all kinds of different farm animals, and looking back, maybe I'm, you know, looking back through rosy glasses or something, but they all seem to be happy. And, you know, the thought of being a farmer in a community of farmers and mistreating your animals, it just doesn't ring true. So there must be something
absolutely.
Else. Now you
yeah,
were,
and I,
go ahead.
And I do think it is, you know, just a philosophical opposition to raising animals for any sort of end use. So I do think it is a deeper philosophical question and not a concern for any individual animal's welfare.
Well, you represent a real broad spectrum of farm, ranch, and hunting organizations. Do hunters and farmers usually get together, or are they by and large in different camps for the most?
I will say in Oregon, and I don't know if our experience is the same as other states, but in Oregon, we've always worked really closely with the hunting and outdoor recreation communities because there's just a lot of shared values and a lot of shared goals within those communities in terms of responsible animal management. And that includes on the agricultural side, you know, making sure we provide habitat for a large chunk. We put up to 70% of the state's wildlife because we tend to have really high quality habitat on our private lands. The hunting and fishing communities recognize that, and we've always partnered really closely together because we all have shared concerns around making sure that we have balanced numbers between, you know, wildlife and predators. So that we don't have predators that are, for example, overabundant on the landscape and start targeting domestic animals. And on the hunting community, another concern has been making sure that that some of the elk and deer populations are not overly targeted by predators. So we just have a lot of shared values around kind of holistic ecosystem management and some of the shared values and coexistence that exist between the ag community and the hunting community.
Well, in many respects, wildlife is really not wild because it is managed to the extent possible by people who monitor population levels and whatnot to make sure things kind of stay in balance. And the hunting and fishing is really what pays for that management, correct?
Yes, in Oregon, our wildlife management is based on the North American model of wildlife, which recognizes harvest and sustainable harvest is a key element of the protection of wildlife species. And our Department of Fish and Wildlife is largely fee funded from hunting and fishing licenses in our state.
Well, then to what extent do you see this public initiative, this signing of petitions? To what extent does your coalition of agriculture and hunting groups see this as a threat? Are you taking this seriously? Or are you looking at it and going, these guys are crazy? It ain't going to happen.
So we are taking it seriously, but I think we're also looking at it and hoping. I think anybody that starts to dig into what the ballot initiative actually does and what the effect would be across all aspects of Oregon's landscape from, you know, your homeowner in downtown Portland, all the way out to folks living and working in rural Oregon, we're hoping that if people can actually see what it does, I think they will all say, oh my goodness, this goes way too far. Even people that, you know, think we shouldn't eat animals or think we shouldn't harvest animals, I think even recognize it goes too far. I think the concern that we have is when folks are signing an initiative to get a ballot measure to qualify for the ballot, and often when they're voting on a measure, it's not always with full information about what it does. And so I think they can buy a tagline of, you know, help protect farm animals from abuse and think, oh man, you know, we need to do that. We need to vote yes on this. And I think for us, we're like, hey, farm animals are already protected from abuse, and that's not what this does. This is about stopping the whole industry in the state and stopping hunting, fishing, and pest control. And so I think we're hoping people will dig deeper, but taking it very seriously because we know that people often don't.
Well, in looking around the world, all over the place, here in California, they're pretty much putting the pork business out of business by forcing the pork producers to increase the size of the pork pens to the extent that the pork prices will go up 50% is what they're thinking. But looking at most of these things, they seem unreasonable, and yet they're getting signatures. And so we read this initiative and we think there's no way animal agriculture or wildlife management or living in the country, there's no way we can do this anymore if something like this takes effect. Am I wrong?
Absolutely. No, I think that's absolutely true. And I think the thing that we fear most, and it goes broader than this initiative, and it does hit kind of what we're seeing across the food chain, is I think people have this ethos and this goal for things to look a certain way, and can easily buy into something of like, oh, I'm preventing animal abuse if I do this, without recognizing that you're actually killing those small farmers and ranchers that you want to have exist and that you want to have be in the state. The bigger guys will leave the state. The smaller guys will go out of business. If this happens in enough places, that production leaves the country, but we still import. And so I think there's a place where you're actually, you know, I think, and sometimes in trying to achieve the objectives that people, and particularly folks that are a little disconnected from the food chain, that in trying to achieve the objectives that they want, they end up actually outsourcing to places where there aren't the same animal welfare standards, there aren't the same animal laws, there aren't the same environmental laws. And so the desire for the consumption, the desire to buy the product doesn't go down. You just end up outsourcing to a place where you don't know if the workers are protected, you don't know if the environment's protected, you don't know if the animals are protected and what their certification looks like. And I think for our producers, that's actually the scariest thing is, you know, we all understand people have to eat. But when people kind of vote without understanding what they're voting for or push for something that they don't understand the full effects of it, you can end up killing an entire industry in a state or in a nation only to export from places that are actually worse in comparison to the objective that you wanted to achieve. And it's very hard to find an effective way to get people to understand that nuance and have that conversation.
And then that is the story of American business over the last 50 years. We've chased all the business out of business to China, and where we're now importing things that are ultimately much dirtier than we chased away. This is The Food Chain, right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, what if we passed a law that made animal husbandry illegal? We made it so onerous that farmers could not raise animals, and hunters could not hunt animals, and you could not go out in your garage and set a rat trap, because killing a rat is animal cruelty. Well, that's pretty much the case with Proposition 13 in Oregon, where they are gathering signatures to put this into law. And it would make it nearly impossible. I don't see how it could be possible for farmers to raise animals, for wildlife people to manage wildlife, for us to manage our homesteads and our homes. Because everything that is related to animals, it would be protected. And so it seems almost impossible, and yet you look around the world, and that is the trend, to put these rules and regulations on our agriculture with respect to animals. We have Mary Ann Cooper with us today, and she is the Vice President of Public Policy for Oregon Farm Bureau. And she's working with a coalition of agriculture groups to see if she can protect our right to grow animals. And you're really on the firing line, not for just for Oregon, but for everybody, I think. Are you getting comments from farm bureaus around the country?
Oh, yes. And it is not a new place for us in Oregon. We often see, I'd say West Coast wide, but particularly in Oregon, you know, we'll see a trend or a piece of legislation or kind of a movement, often a couple years before it hits the rest of the nation. So I do think Oregon is kind of a test ground and a breeding ground for some of the kind of emerging issues in agriculture, and especially in terms of what we see in our ballot measure. We have an easier process than a lot of states to get initiative petitions and get ballot measures on our ballot. So I think it also makes us an attractive state for people looking to try out new ideas or new proposals that they're getting ready to gear up nationwide.
So essentially, if you're an animal rights activist or a vegetarian, you can grab a petition, walk down the street of a big city in Oregon and say, we are going to end animal cruelty once and for all, and we're going to stop eating meat. And boy, I bet you get a lot of people sign up, because a lot of people have lost contact with food.
Yeah, and I think that to me the most interesting thing about this is, you know, when I've heard kind of public messaging from the Yes campaign, they're sharing values that they're saying, oh, this will accomplish, you know, ending animal abuse and ending, you know, all of these cruel practices that they think exist on farms and ranches. And I think we look at it and we're like, hey, we want to end animal abuse too. And if somebody's doing something that's abusive, we absolutely should stop it. And I think the issue is that the stuff that they think is animal abuse, it's often because they don't understand the reason that we do it and the need to do it on the farm. And I think that really goes back to the need for education to connect people back to what happens on the farm and saying, hey, this might look, you know, for example, placing an animal in a chute to doctor it, that might look cruel to you. It may not look like the animal doesn't want to be there. But what you're actually doing is helping make sure that animal is going to live a long and healthy life, and giving them either vaccinations that they need, or, you know, dealing with an infection that they've developed from being out on the range or from being, you know, hurting their foot in the pasture, et cetera. So it's, I think there's just a huge element of education here about why we do some of what we do and how it's needed for the ultimate health and longevity of the animal. And I think that's, you know, something that this has showed us, we really need to throw open the barn doors as it is and let folks know why we do what we do and how it's not abuse and how a measure like this isn't going to stop animal abuse. It's just going to make it so people can't make a living anymore and put these small farms and ranches that is the actual precise place that people want to buy their meat and want to buy their eggs and want to buy their milk. It's just going to put them out of business.
Well, you brought up the notion of the fact that a lot of this is based on basic philosophical dilemmas. And so I'd like to pick up one and start with the good book that tells us, be fruitful and multiply. fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds and the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And so I'd like to ask you, Marianne Cooper, Vice President of Policy for Oregon Farm Bureau, what happens if we don't take dominion over the animals? What happens if we don't, if we just let them go, which it seems to be what they want? They just want us to let them go. What happens to
them? Yeah, well, and I mean, hopefully we never see if my prediction is right. But I think, and we have this conversation a lot in terms of even kind of ecology and environmental restoration, as people think, oh, you just set everything free and, you know, the earth will heal and things will go back to being so perfect. And that's just not remotely accurate with the world that we live in today. And, you know, under this measure, I don't think anybody would just be setting animals free. And quite frankly, I don't think anyone in the state would like it if they were. Because you develop huge pockets of overuse and areas where fuel loads build up because, you know, if you look at, for example, grazing, animal managers work to keep animals up out of the riparian and have them graze some of the upland areas that need to be grazed for fuel load. If you just say, turning you loose and animals go have your own dominion, you'd end up with ecological outcomes that you wouldn't want. I think what would more likely happen is you would see a lot of that rangeland and a lot of pasture land and other, you know, some things would transition to other cultivated crops in our state. I think most of our livestock would get shipped out of state because, you know, even though technically you could raise them here and just slaughter them out of state, the risk of you being charged with a felony for trimming a hoof too close is not going to be a risk most people would take. And so, you know, I think they would ship those animals to other states that don't have this law. And you would see a lot of rangeland fall into, you know, way too high of fuel loads, perpetuating the terrible wildfires we've seen in the West. Some of those rip right down the riparian areas where they aren't grazed for maintenance. And then you'd also see, you know, either we maybe still grow hay and be exporting it to other states where they still could raise livestock. The most fascinating one to me would be to see what would happen when the rats took dominion
there you
for
go.
Our urban areas. Because I do live in the Portland area, and we have a huge rat issue. I actually have a pest guy myself, and he's like, oh, yeah, we're one of the most rat-heavy states in the nation because we just have really ideal conditions for them to thrive. And so people would literally have their homes overrun with rats they couldn't control, and you'd probably have, you know, people breaking the law in the dead of night to try to rid themselves of their war on rats. And so it is not a future that I hope I ever live to see.
Well, in that regard, you know, it seems to me that if we make it against the law or a Class C felony, as the case may be, to take dominion over animals, and nobody takes dominion over animals because of that, well, it seems to me that we are, in essence, depriving animals of the opportunity to live.
Because I mean, we definitely would be depriving them of, you know, so there, I think, well, arguably, veterinarians could still practice, but you would absolutely, I mean, some of our wildlife managers, all of the good things that people do to help animals live long and healthy lives, you couldn't do. And so I definitely think it would be a grim future for all of us.
Yeah, if you can't tend an animal, if you can't take dominion over it, if you can't do anything with it, then who's going to have it? You know, I see a piece earlier today about a group of animal rights activists. They have been kidnapping cows and farm animals that are scheduled for slaughter, and they bring them to their animal rescue facilities where they tend them all day long. But in that circumstances, I'm sure they would be breaking the law too, even though, you know, they're doing what they can to save the animals' lives. What they're doing would be illegal under Proposition 13, because for sure they're doing something, you know, that would ruffle the feathers of the critter and be felonious activity. So it just seems to me like if you had these draconian laws, nobody would want to have an animal. And if people do not want to have an animal, how on earth would animals have the opportunity to live? Where would they live? Would they wander the street?
Yeah, I mean, I read an article a couple of years back about kind of packs of stray dogs that were forming and wreaking havoc. I want to say it was in a city in Mexico because they didn't have animal control anymore. I think, again, and you know, the most extreme extension of this, I actually think that's what happened.
What else could happen? You know, what else could happen?
Right. Well, and I think that, to me, the interesting thing is this is, to me, a perfect example of a law that is so strict that I think you'd have a lot of conflict with local law enforcement, where animal rights activists would be like, arrest this person, they've committed a crime. And, you know, sheriff would be like, well, I didn't give up my dog. Was I supposed to give up my dog? And, you know, it's the perfect example of unintended consequences where you create a crime that I don't think would be supported by society at large. And I think it would cause all sorts of unequal and unfair application across different segments of society. Because you're right. Like, it would be a crime for me to cut my dog's toenail too short. And would I then give up my dog because I'm afraid of that outcome happening? Or would I just stop? I have a golden doodle who, I don't know if you know very much about them, but they grow hair basically and have to be groomed regularly. You know, if I wouldn't be able to find a groomer to groom him. He would get, it would be absolutely detrimental to his health to grow as much hair as he would grow at the end of not being able to have a groomer, and me being afraid to do it over risk of, you know, injury, and I don't know what I'm doing. And there's just all sorts of outcomes like that, I love my dog. I don't know that I would turn him loose to society, but if I couldn't find somebody to groom him, I don't know what I would do. He would definitely get sicker.
Yeah.
What do you end up having to have vets become de facto animal groomers? Cause they're the only ones that are allowed to, you know, nick an animal's fur without it being a felony. There's just all sorts of really crazy things that could happen in society if this passed, that I think, again, would be, to your point, so much worse for animals' health than all of the good husbandry practices that we're able to practice right now.
Well, it's interesting, in the very beginning of the Bible, that's the first, one of the first things laid on the table. Take dominion. And dominion, as Dr. Temple Grandin points out, is not taking advantage of something, but taking responsibility for it. So the good book tells us we are to take responsibility for our animals and our wildlife. And that means we're in charge and responsible for. And these forms of life are not given to us to do anything but to be responsible for and to provide for our sustenance. So, you know, in wondering where the antipathy toward animal agriculture comes, I think a lot of it has to do with the videos that come out of confined animal feeding operations. And, you know, people go into animal feedlots and take pictures of the animals in close conditions. And, you know, it looks pretty sad when it gets right down to it. But I got to thinking, Marianne, when it gets right down to it, it's just like a city. And, you know, we put animals in confined animal feeding operations and we call it animal cruelty. But we put people in big cities and we call it city living. So I'm not sure that those confined animal feeding operations are all that bad, especially when you have people like Dr. Temple Grandin who are teaching animal feedlot personnel how to do it in a very holistic and animal-friendly way.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I had not heard that comparison before, but I think it's a good one. And it is, to me, some of it is also, you know, some of those videos are places where, you know, the animals were in some cases injured out on the pasture and they're brought inside for caretaking, and you take a video of that. And I'm like, it'd be walking into, you know, a hospital where people are actively being treated and being like, oh man, you know, see how out of shape this person is, you know, that's all of society. And that's just not the case. In any animal operation, you're going to have areas where you have animals that got sick that need doctoring. And if you're somebody that remotely cares for your animals, you're going to do that. And you're going to make sure that they get the care that they need. But sometimes if an animal's gotten sick, if they've gotten a, you know, what the equivalent of a stomach bug, you know, it's not going to look great for a few days until they start to recover. And I think that the videos we've seen capitalize on some of those moments, or tricky camera angles or other things to make things look somehow nefarious, when ultimately there is a reason, a really reason related to animal husbandry and good animal care for doing those practices that just, you know, don't look good if they're caught from a certain angle on camera with a certain background. And so it's just, and to me, even a great example is, and it's Measure Target, that, you know, people think of artificial insemination, they think, oh man, that's so terrible. Why'd you do that to an animal? And yet, you know, IVF technology for humans is one of the most amazing things in the world. And, the, you know, equivalent artificial insemination for animals happened because there's a lot less injury and stress on the animal in most cases from doing it that way. And for the, types of animals where people regularly do artificial insemination. And it can also improve genetics to make you have stronger and healthier animals over time. And
all of that is a Class C felony under Oregon's Proposition 13. Well, Marianne, as a warrior for the California Farm Bureau, your job is to turn this around. So when we get back from this coming break, we're going to talk about what agriculture can do to fight back and save itself and our food supply. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Please do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. Yes, we have a few minutes left, not many, and probably never enough to figure this conundrum out. But we must try and keep trying because this is our food chain. My notion that is that a lot of this is coming from people who don't want us to eat real food. They would rather have us eating the manufactured food for which they have patents, which means nobody can compete with them. They would much rather have us eating their manufactured foods rather than real foods produced by real people on real farms. And I guess if I was to have a jihad, that would be it, is to fight back against that. And that's your job, Marianne Cooper, is it not?
No, absolutely. And I think that's, again, you know, some of these things are just not unique to the animal industry in terms of, you know, some of the... It's an interesting moment in time where on one hand you have a whole natural foods movement and people getting back to ancient grains and being concerned by some of the pretty amazing technological advances that we've had in our agricultural systems. But on the other hand, you have people saying, well, you know, my lab grown meat is actually better for you than, and, you know, better for the environment than your, you know, locally raised grass fed sustainable beef. And I don't think those things square. I think we need to continue to give our farmers access to improved technology, both on farm and, you know, there's some amazing advances in animal health and welfare that have come out of the last decade as well. But also focus on making sure that our food is, you know, that we have a reliable local food supply. And that we aren't reliant on, and to the point you made of a lot of our manufacturing having moved to China, that we're not reliant on technologies and processes that require components from outside our nation, that the COVID epidemic certainly taught us are not easy to come by as people are waiting, you know, 6 months for delivery of their washer and dryer. So I think that for us, our absolute goal is to protect Oregon family farmers and ranchers, and to make sure that we have local sustainable food systems, that we're not exporting all of our food production to another country, or, you know, exporting all of our food production to labs that rely on components from other countries.
Well, I've had a little bit of experience in Oregon agriculture. I grew some, I was engaged in the elephant garlic trade in the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon, and I picked a lot of strawberries in the Willamette Valley, and it's such a beautiful place. And, you know, Marianne, it wasn't so long ago, a couple generations, most all Oregonians probably lived on the land or very close to it or had a grandpa and grandma who did. They're all gone now, except for a few, and most everybody lives in the city and raised their children in the city. And the city doesn't teach children much about agriculture. It's probably on the bottom of the list of things to teach children. It's about where your food comes from. And so you have children who are taught to listen to certain voices. And my guess is that the Oregon Farm Bureau is not one of them. That's just the way it is. You know, you represent a very small minority of the people. So how are we going to fight back?
And we spend a lot of time talking about this, and we have some pretty amazing educational programs in Oregon. We actually have an education foundation within Oregon Farm Bureau that focuses a lot of time on educating teachers so that they're teaching their students, you know, accurate information about agriculture and about the importance of our food systems. But we also have programs like Ag in the Classroom and Adopt a Farmer, where we have farmers that go into classrooms and teach about agriculture and teach about their farms, as well as places where, you know, a class can adopt a farmer and go, you know, hear from them and see from them what life is like on the farm. But it is, I think, a growing challenge just because you know, not a lot of people don't remember a lot of what they learn when they're in school. And then once people get out of school, I think, you know, life takes over and you get really busy and you just don't spend, until something goes wrong with your food supply, you don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. And it's a conversation, again, as I mentioned, I grew up in rural Oregon on a cattle ranch, and I now live in urban Oregon. And most of my friends are from urban settings from around the nation. And it is very interesting kind of what they know about agriculture and then just what they believe to be true. So, you know, I think sometimes farmers don't give the public enough credit for, you know, they do understand where their food comes from, and they do understand that food comes from farms, and they do understand, you know, what are animal products and what aren't, and the broad strokes. What they don't always understand and what is, you know, really prone to a lot of information is misinformation is, one, how that food is grown and kind of what care the farmer took and what the farmer's needs were to be able to stay in production and be able to keep having that local safe food supply. But then also, secondly, what, you know, laws and protections are already in place, how people do what they do. And I think that's a place where this initiative petition is trying to target this fear that people have that, you know, their animal ag, that their animal food systems are not treating animals fairly and are not doing a good job. And I think, to the point that I made of opening up the barn doors, I think that's a place we're really going to have to, you know, connect them in with farmers and ranchers here in the state that are doing, that are raising animals, and have them hear firsthand what it's like. And there is some really phenomenal work being done in that arena. There's a dairy farmer from Tillamook that started a wildly successful, I think it started out as a blog, but he's now on Instagram and Facebook and has a tremendous number of followers. And it's in part because he shows all aspects of dairy farming, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, everything in between. And I think a lot of people really appreciate that versus, you know, I think some of the folks that kind of got in the social media game early thought, oh, people just want to see the happy pictures of the cows in the pastures. You know, they don't want to see what happens when, you know, I'm pulling a calf and it goes badly. Or, you know, I'm doctoring this cow because they were out in the pasture and, you know, something got on their hoof and they got an abscess. And so I do think him kind of throwing open the door and showing and explaining why everything that he does, why he does it. I mean, he also does a lot of just kind of debunking what claims are made about what happens in dairies generally. I think stuff like that really helps educate people because, you know, you just think of how busy people are. It's, to me, it's, you know, I think the farming community places a lot of blame on people of like, oh, they don't know or they don't care. And it's like, no, they're just as busy as you are. And they've just got a lot going on. And as long as the food's there, you know, most people only kind of hear bits and pieces. And sometimes when the voice that's allowed is saying, oh, there's a problem with this industry, they don't really know what the problem is, but they believe that one exists. And they believe that they, you know, when given the opportunity, they need to vote to save it. And I think that's what we've got to figure out how to combat, is just really showing people what actually happens on a farm or ranch and, you know, what actually goes into raising animals in a way that they're going to connect with and in a way that respects how busy their lives are.
And, you know, that's one of the things that really makes that difficult is that traditionally media puts its ag farm programming on like 4 o'clock on Saturday morning or something like that when, you know, kids certainly aren't going to be watching. I have often had the opportunity to speak at high schools about food. And one of the tricks that I learned that really helped is that I bring in 2 eggs, one from my local farmer's market and the other from a cheap egg from, you know, the big box store. And I have 2 saucers and I hold up these eggs and I say, kids, can you tell the difference between these 2 eggs? One was a farmer's market egg and one was a supermarket egg. Can you tell me the difference? Well, of course not. An egg is an egg is an egg. But then I have them come up and I crack the eggs in the saucer. And there are the 2 eggs. And I have them feel the shells. And I have them look at how one egg stands up, golden rich color, and stands up proudly, the yolk does in the saucer, and the other one just flat with a dull yellow yolk, and the eggshell's really thin, and I don't have to say a word. And you could just see the dawning of an idea that an egg is not just an egg, that it's something different. and that to find that egg, I mean, which egg do you want to eat? And you have to find it. And if you have to find it, that means you have to be a seeker. You have to start looking at where your food comes from. And, you know, that's probably going to be the hardest thing in the world to get kids to do, because food comes in brightly colored packages. And it's heavily advertised on television. And it's so easy, you just open it and eat it. So it's a big job that agriculture must do. But you must do it.
Yep, absolutely. And I mean, I even think part of it is, and to the point that you just made, you know, the understanding the why that, you know, I think there's differences in diet, different, you know, breeds of chickens, that there's just, and I think that's been the hardest part in the food system is identifying what people care about and identifying how to have the conversation, because, you know, health wise, I think studies have shown there's not a huge difference in those two eggs. But if people have a value that aligns right with the farmer's market egg, or they, you know, want the brighter yolk or the different diet in the chicken, absolutely do it. And so I think that to me is a huge part of just the conversations that we try to have with people. And that, but you know, when there's so much information out there and people are telling you, well, this thing's good, and someone else is saying, oh no, it's bad. I don't blame people for not knowing what to think. And I don't blame people for, you know, and I think that gets back to this ballot initiative, is the easy thing to do to say, well, you know, I don't want animal abuse, so I guess I'll vote yes. I think that's the biggest thing that we've got to combat, is that's not what you're doing here. What you're doing here is killing entire industries and setting forth a chain of events that could result in absolute chaos in our state. And in fact, make it so you can't own your dog that you love so much that you adopted during the pandemic. So it's, you know, I think,
so it seems, I guess, to, it seems to me like,
I just don't blame people for being confused.
Well, of course, we're all confused when it gets right down to it. I've been doing this radio show for well over 1,200 Saturdays, and I'm confused a lot. But, you know, it seems to me like when it comes down to, for this fight for Oregon, it would behoove agriculture to get tough with the words and state in no uncertain terms that to pass this law is to eliminate animals.
Yep.
This law is an anti-animal law. This law is not anti-farmer. This law is not anti-animal abuse. This law is anti-animal. This law seeks to get rid of animals, because nobody is going to want to have an animal under these conditions.
I absolutely agree. And I agree with you that I think our messaging has to be clear, that it has to be clear and unequivocal that this, to your point, it's not anti-animal abuse, it's anti-animal. And I think the trickiest thing about that is getting people to understand that, for example, we're not talking about somebody, you know, tying their dog out and leaving it without food and water for days. That's already illegal. That's already animal abuse, and no one would have any trouble prosecuting that. We're talking about, you know, can I take my doodle to the groomer? And what happens if that groomer, you know, nicks his skin or accidentally cuts his nail too short and cuts the quick? That groomer won't be in business anymore. That groomer won't be there for you to take your dog to, because that risk of cutting their quick is now all of a sudden the risk of, you know, criminal penalties or not. And no one's going to take that risk. And so I do think we have to be as strong as they will be pretending that this is for the animals, as I explained, this is actually against the animals and against anyone who tries to take care of them.
And that includes your pet dog, and it includes the rat in your basement you're trying to get rid of. So it's going to be a very interesting fight, because I bet that enough Oregonians will sign this petition. So this will be on the books, and you'll have to fight it. And the way to fight it is to play as tough as they are, I think, and position this as being anti-animal. And well, what about you? What do you think this is going to end up as. Marianne, you're the one right there in Oregon, in Portland.
I will say, I will
in Salem.
Fight a big fight and invest on the front end to try to make sure this never makes it onto the ballot, because, you know, I don't think it is worth anyone's vote or worth anyone's time to consider, because it is so extreme and has such large, I don't even want to say unintended consequences, because I believe they might be intended. But, you know, our state does have an initiative petition process that is easier than other states to qualify. And so we are fighting that battle. And I think our biggest hope and our biggest encouragement for anybody in Oregon or elsewhere that's paying attention to this is, don't take it for granted. Don't say, oh, of course, it'll never happen. You know, we've got to work to make sure it doesn't happen, and we've got to work to educate folks. And all of that work is, I think, time well spent anyways, because it helps people understand their food systems, their interactions with animals, and just the world around them a little bit better.
Marianne Cooper, Vice President of Public Policy at the Oregon Farm Bureau, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck, and fight the good fight for all of us, okay?
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You bet.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.